We'll get started now. Our first speaker is Professor Debra Davis.
So I should just, everyone can hear me if I speak from here? Is that what the, you like that? Okay. I don't know how many of you read the paper. I sent it about a month ago, but maybe it wasn't circulated. It wasn't circulated. Okay. First, I wanted to thank you all for including me. It is true that I work on the urban middle classes, but I have come at it in a different way, and so for me, this was really exciting time just to think things through. And I chose this topic, guessing who might be in the audience. It's probable political trajectory of the urban middle classes in post-socialist but still communist China. The beginning of the paper, very briefly, the setup is sort of where I am. I did a project almost 10 years ago about the transition to socialism, and I looked at three metropolitan areas, Guangzhou, Shanghai, and Wuhan, and I was interested, having written on social mobility, inequality, I did a lot of life course material on occupational histories, and so I had this, I had 1,000 life histories that I had collected. And what I decided to do was go through the documentary materials that were actually published between 1949 and 1953 and look at that transition into socialism. And at that time, there were a group of people, both historians and economists, who said that the year of 1949 was a year of no significance, and that if we really wanted to get the big picture on China across the long 20th century, 49 was really not going to be the critical turning point. So I, in a very modest way, I said, okay, I'm going to look at this for the transition for what I call the upper middle class by occupation, managers and professionals with college educations, and ask what happened to them in this transition to socialism. And what I found, not entirely to my surprise, but in perhaps with greater force from the documentary sources than I expected, or greater consistency, I would say, was that within a very, very short time, 1953, the new regime, the new party state, having replaced a previous party state, completely eliminated the upper middle class as an autonomous social strata. And this group of people, whether they were already managers or professionals, or whether they were the ones who were being prepared and then assigned jobs in those areas, basically became members of the nomenklatura. And there was no exit from this. There was no option of self-employment. In terms of the consumption issue, their housing, urban land was entirely nationalized. There was no way you could display your distinction through your housing, through your consumption. And as the regime matured, particularly through the Cultural Revolution era, all those kinds of class distinction were eliminated. And finally, in terms of associational activity, that is, to what extent, you know, we think of upper middle class as professional managerial strata or class, whichever word you prefer to use, one of their key historical experiences has been in creating associational life. Talked about the professions in India and how important the professional associations are. We've done this in other countries. So another thing I looked at, of course, was what happened to professional associations, of which there were many and which were very important politically, and they also were totally eliminated, totally eliminated. The regime that was began, the People's Republic of China, established in 49, was extremely successful from the start in the way in which they incorporated this group of expert knowledge into the political machine. And if one had any ambitions, therefore, of being politically active or of political consequence, one had to do it within the Communist Party. If you were not accepted into membership or you didn't play by the rules for promotion, you were marginalized. That doesn't mean you couldn't have been a professional or a manager, but you would not get to exercise authority in the workplace, which I consider to be one of the conditions of being really a member of the upper middle class. So I have I have always enjoyed Eric Olin Wright's work, built on Eric Olin Wright's work. And then more recently, what I've done is I've combined it with a Bourdieu thing, which we call the multiple capitals. So I have measures of cultural capital, social capital, political capital, human capital, and financial capital. And then we do these analyses of how these things have and have not changed. So I'm deeply invested in this particular query, although I'm not invested in any particular theoretical model or conclusions. So for this paper, I did this mind game, which was say, okay, I think I know what happened to the upper middle class defined as college-educated managers and professionals in that early phase, 49 to 53, in these urban settings. And what's happened since then? We know now that the economy has been largely privatized. Most people work in private sector employment. The state has withdrawn from many different areas. They allow a range of associational activity, many of it actually quite free. You're supposed to register with the state, but others can function without registering for the state. So associational freedom of association has come back in a certain way for professionals. They have the option of exit from state employment. Excuse me. They can choose self-employment where they can accumulate wealth and assets. And then the consumption side, I did a book called The Consumer Revolution in Urban China. And the focus, of course, was thinking about how people display distinction. In fact, when I read Distinction for the first time, after it was translated, my immediate response was, you know, I wanted to do a Chinese distinctions because it was so perfect for China. And I never fulfilled that ambition, but I wrote these other little things that let me think through some of those issues. And the bottom line is that this many people are using consumption and increased affluence to define themselves vis-a-vis other people. And so whether it's clothing, food, recreation, et cetera, one of the footnotes I have there is to a paper we did with logs of people's gifting, visiting, and exchanging of greetings at the Chinese New Year, which is the most important still kind of social networking moment. And we had them keep logs for the 6 days, and we created these very elaborate measures of network, and then we analyzed them according to occupation. And it was a very nice result in social forces. We were very happy with that. So I am very interested in how one tries to capture the full range of assets or capitals that individuals have, but particularly that households have. And so I have worked pretty hard to try to create these projects which follow households and follow them over time and do inventories of what they own and what they do and what they think. And you know, it's fascinating, and I'm not always so parsimonious probably in what I do with this treasure house, but it keeps me endlessly amused. So what I'm going to do in the next 10 minutes is just talk about what I think is the case for this upper middle class in urban areas in terms of politics. The naive often have looked to this group in the Chinese case, partly based on what they saw in Taiwan, as a precursor to democracy. In the last 5 years, I think people are not so naive, and some of the material I have in the paper, I'm not going to walk through it in the oral presentation with the surveys, shows why people are no longer so naive. And I'll just quickly give some background and then wait for the questions to see how we go further. Also, my paper does not end with a conclusion that wraps it up, but because I didn't quite understand the format for today, but ended with four questions. And what I'll do here is just identify those questions, but stress the last question, raising a question, an issue which hasn't, I haven't heard anybody else talk about it yet. So I think all the sociologists and others that are here know that the issue is class and inequality. And this is just a quick shorthand. What is the story of China in this period of rapid growth, the movement away from socialism, actually the complete rejection of the socialist blueprint, and the blue line, the green line at the top is the national Gini, and so it's at, technically this is for 2002, at 0.45. Sometimes the Chinese will say it's at 0.5. It depends what we put in there to crunch the numbers. So it's about the same as the United States, but not as bad as Brazil. In the rural areas, they started a higher level of inequality within urban rural areas than the urban, and the difference narrows. And now, in fact, the urban inequality, if we carried it, would come much closer to rural. So they're moving in that direction within. But the gap between rural and urban is so large that that's why we've green line on the top is high and keeps rising. One of the chapters we have in the inequality book uses data which not only puts in income but puts in the benefits. And China, like most places, the Gini for benefits is terrible and gotten worse. So it's like 0.7 in rural areas and about 0.6 in urban areas. And if we talk about quality of life, which I think is critical for understanding people's class status and this question of insecurity, we need the benefits piece. And when we look at benefits plus income, China looks worse than this. And to speak to our concerns here with insecurity, people in China are very insecure right now. And that's up and down the income level. So just to give you a sense of how many people I might be talking about, and I'll quickly show you a ladder that gives all the percentages. This is the percentage of people who managers who have workplace authority, and this is the percentage of professionals. And I am very, in my own work, in the paper that I'm writing now for Brookings, because partly the data supports it, but also it's theoretically driven at the beginning, managers and professionals are quite different. And in analysis, it's really important to keep these people separate and to analyze them to make sure that they are, to actually know in what ways they're similar and what ways they're different. And I think it's very important about intergenerational mobility, about career mobility, about relationship to the state, these questions of autonomy and authority, and how one feels where you'll have efficacy. And managers and professionals, as in the United States and every other society that I've looked at, are not the same, and yet they often are grouped together. And so to give you a sense of how China compares now, it's, I'd say, roughly comparable to Thailand and in 1992 and India in 1992. These are numbers I took from secondary sources, and they may be completely wrong, but I can certainly give, I will be very much appreciative if people would send me corrections to this. And this is much lower than Malaysia and Korea. So it gives us a sense of where China might be nationwide. Now, what I'm going to talk about is just urban China, where this group is most concentrated and politically is of perhaps greater consequence. This is from the national survey that was done by colleagues at the Academy of Social Sciences. So I've highlighted in yellow, state and social administrators, 2%, the managerial, 1.6, and then they tell you which ones are high, middle, and low. Private entrepreneurs, that's really wealthy, industrials, 1%, professional technical, 4.6, clerical, 7.2, the individual entrepreneur, 7.1, commercial, 11, industrial workers, 17, agriculture, 42, and then the urban and rural jobless, which is rather low. And it's true, the last 25 years of growth in China has created virtually a full employment, although underemployment for those people who are full-time agriculture is, of course, a serious problem and produces this endless stream of young people out of the countryside to take the jobs, domestic service being one of them, but construction and other kinds of service work actually being the most important. The industrial worker one I do flag because people's perception is, that China's this industrial giant and it's grown through its growth of industry. In fact, industrial jobs peaked in 1995. They've held steady. They probably won't go, Peter Evans thinks, about more than 15% of the labor force. What has happened in China, it's been a greenfield. They closed down the very large state-owned industrial enterprises, which created an urban proletariat, which created, of course, the leading class of the communist revolution, and in many ways, those people enjoyed the fruits of socialism. They have been erased. And now what is an industrial worker are first-generation young people from the farms. So there's all kinds of interesting class theory and class discussions that one can have about China, which doesn't easily fit other places' experience. Now, the urban part, as you might expect, more managers and more professionals. So it looks closer to Hong Kong. So the problem I've been struggling with this last month as I've been trying to write this paper for Brookings is how do we match the income data, which the Chinese provide fairly generously with the occupational data. And it has been a nightmare, and we do not have good answers. I'll just say that in question and answer. We can deal with it if that's something that interests you. To give you a sense now of this, using income as opposed to occupation, what's happening in China, this gap issue that all of us have talked about, and the rich. I agree very much with Noha that if we're talking about class formation and the anxieties of people in that 80th and 90th decile, they are looking up. They are not looking down. And so what this shows you is that after China entered WTO in 2001 and really took the capitalist turn, the top 10% in China have just moved out ahead, and they live a life like no one else. And they have enormous wealth. I have a few things I'll show you here. They tend to be connected to the state. Not all of them, but the pathway to real riches in communist capitalist China has been through these state connections, whether it's natural resources that have been sold or former state companies, which now function in different ways, and real estate, because all land is still collectively owned. So the group that I'm interested in is that brown group, the next 10%. I think that's where I can put my upper middle class professionals. The next group down, the next 20%, we might call the lower middle class, and then the middle. As a sociologist, you know, when I get fed up with some of the chatter, I will just say, middle, okay, draw a line, that's the middle. Is that what you're talking about? And of course, it's not what we're talking about. But this gives you a sense, which is what we're interested in. If that's the actual middle, 20% by income, household per capita income, where do the other deciles relate to that? And what you see very clearly is that China in these last 7 years has become increasingly unequal when you look at the very top. There's still gains at the bottom. There's still fewer people in poverty. So the boat is rising, and that explains a lot of the politics. People are insecure. People are very worried. People near the top are looking at those who really have moved into a stratosphere, sending their children overseas to school, driving BMWs, having five servants, having three houses. It is a level of affluence that is impressive. Even if it were in, maybe not Princeton, but in New Haven, this would be a very high level of consumption, certainly higher than what I enjoy. So this is just small stuff to remind us. I do care about consumers, and I could show you 1,000 pictures. I'm just showing you one. The cell phone thing, there was a question earlier. So this addresses China. Cell phones are everywhere. You can see for the lowest 10%, it's 100 households, 100 cell phones. There might be someone without a cell phone, but it's really rare. And what's interesting here is the difference between the computers and the microwave. That's a sort of fun thing to look at. And you can see they're just about the same. Of course, they are not the same price, but that speaks to certain things that are happening. And if I have my slides and talk to you about the housing and consumer durables, we'd see that the distribution by income is far more exaggerated than the distribution by consumption, which is something that sociologists talk about. We know that. But I just wanted to underline it because consumption can be compressed in a way that income is not. On the other hand, it gives people a sense of achievement. It gives people a sense of ownership. It can give people a sense of identity and how they express the identity. We look at the computer, of course, in a different way as an access to all kinds of information. So it's not just being modern. It's really functioning in a very global way, and people are connected outside of China, and they are very dependent on their computers. And you look at the bottom 10%, computers are there too. So this is a signal of where urban China, how quickly it's moving and continues to move ahead, and how people share that excitement about moving ahead across income groups. They may feel insecure about the future. They certainly, the new college graduates, are insecure as they look forward for their jobs. But as people, and this is one of the footnotes I have, this is a piece I did in 2005 on consumer culture, people's reference is usually their own past. And they go back 10 years, and they see themselves in a better position. So this leads to high levels of regime legitimacy, speaking to the issues here. We're also interested, of course, in non-wage income, and you can see stocks. Provident funds are this this kind of sharing thing. It's like Singapore, where a portion of your income is deducted and then matched by your employer for housing, and you can draw down on it when you borrow to purchase. It's not the identical to Singapore, but it's that model. You can see the rich are the people who do this kind of thing more than other people. My second group, my next 10%, my upper middle class, are much closer to the middle class than they are to the rich. It was just another way to illustrate that point, which is one of the main points that I would want to make. The last point is about the Communist Party and middle class politics. There is no sign that people see on the horizon. I spoke briefly to Lynn White, and he said, totally agree. So this, if you continue the conversation with Lynn, it will not be dissonant with what I've said here. The Communist Party is growing. It's growing as not only in absolute numbers, but as percentage of this is the total population. And it's particularly targeting college students and the college educated. That's really where they're putting all their efforts at adding new recruits. And so if you'll go the membership and look at percentage of members who are farmers, percentage who are workers, which in the Cultural Revolution was quite relatively high, it just slides and slides and slides. So this is a party that is a technocratic, reinvented itself as a party of technocrats, is absolutely opposes parliamentary elections, opposes a multi-party system. There is an election system at the village. That's the article that we have coming out in CPS. But for the urban people, elections are just not part of the landscape, and people are not particularly interested in it. In the paper, I have summaries of recent surveys that have been done looking at class variation in support of democracy, support of democratic values, engagement in political activities, and the upper middle class is less supportive than the non-middle class, and they are less or no more active than the non-middle class. There's a slight age variation, but it's on the periphery. It's not on the core variables. So the bottom line, and in the paper I talk about this, is that the upper middle class is satisfied generally with what they've achieved with this last 20 years of reform. It fits the Gershenkorn idea of the late developers, where the state has played this key role, and China fits that model. The state has created the affluence and the good times. Regime stability is very important to the upper middle class of professional and managers. And so I ask myself, what are the possibilities that we should be looking at if we're interested in the relationship or the political trajectory, as I said, of the upper middle class, which is the first slide. We won't go back there. So if this is what we're interested in, sorry, there must have been a better way to do that, the probable political trajectory of the upper middle classes. And there are four questions at the end of the paper, which I will just tell you, but I'm going to just speak to the last one. And the first one is the one that we've already thrown out, which is this question about growing inequality. And how will growing inequality affect the political trajectory of this upper middle class? And it partly speaks to what you said that you wanted me to speak about, what things, if things go down. At the moment, I mean, this is an open question. We don't know. But I think to the extent we have information on it, we don't expect this particular strata to find themselves disengaged or antagonistic to the current leadership. They will be part of the decision-making. They see themselves protected by that. I think the question would be, how do we see their relationship change to other groups? The other question, I'm just going to do three of the questions. The second one is about the will it be like Taiwan? That's what people always ask me, so I have it in there. And I don't think so. And the number one reason why, it's the simplest answer, is that Taiwan's democratic revolution depended on the ethnic split between the Taiwanese and the mainlanders. In other words, it was a democracy because it was a cross-class coalition. It was not a democratic movement led by professional managerial experts with modern values. It's a ethnic cross-class mobilization. At least That's what I'm proposing. And I'm not alone. This is not something I thought up. That's sort of a general opinion. The last is my most radical, and this is where we go into new territory. That I ask myself, where would there be cross-class alliances that have political potential or actively political? Where, when we look out over the Chinese landscape, the social landscape, and the political economy, and the way in which the party state is evolving and strengthening itself, where could we potentially see a cross-class mobilization with political implications? And I would suggest that in the case of China and probably elsewhere, we look at religious mobilizations and religious activity. China is in the middle of this incredible religious transformation. If you read the Western press, they focus a lot on the Protestants and evangelical Protestants and the Catholics, and it's true. This Christian mission is huge. I think it probably as a church is planted every day. Millions of people are being baptized. It is the core of their life. Based on my research teams in the last decades, more and more of the people I interact with are Christians, very, very committed Christians. It gives them another way of looking at China. It does lead to these cross-class connections. Falun Gong, of course, gets a huge press outside of China, and that speaks to another kind of charismatic Buddhist informed and grounded kind of religiosity. There's a Taoist religious revival, and these are all very important. And I think there are many of us, particularly sociologists and anthropologists more than the political scientists, who are looking at these groups. As we know, theoretically, they're not supposed to be part of civil society, especially if we have more orthodox European views. Contemporary Chinese political philosophers writing right now in civil society are quite willing to accept certain kinds of organizations. They draw the line at religion, which is a red flag to someone like me. Oh, that must really be important. you're afraid of this. This is something that you're really worried about. And I do think it's an interesting game to play. I haven't thought it completely through, and it's not what I'm personally writing about now, but I wanted to end on it because I just wanted to introduce that idea that politics occurs in multiple locations, not only the home, as Raka has discussed, outside of the usual locations. It occurs not only in the home, but it also occurs in these communal and community, and in this case, if it's a religious communal community, settings in which people will make a commitment to an alternative vision of the future, will make bonds of trust in a horizontal pattern that the Chinese party state finds very, very threatening. And while many of these religious people turn their back on politics, others do not. And in addition, even if they turn their backs on politics explicitly, their actual experience and socialization and process of building an alternative vision of distribution is, I think, ultimately very political. So I will end there.
Jay Gertz.
Thank you. I need to switch to my, life is not fair to the members of the middle class. Not only that I have the last presentation of the day, but also it's the second time in this semester I was invited to a brainstorming conference where someone said, just say something outrageous. And then you discover that in the room you have the best experts in the world on that issue, and everyone else has, really profound research paper on the topic. And you end up with saying something outrageous, really, which may be either completely banal or completely misguided. Now, one of the arguments I want to make, and this is a sort of, going back to Atul's question at the beginning of the conference, how this relates to politics, right? And this, as you, this is John Ritzy, and of course this is Delacroix, symbolic picture of the triumph of bourgeoisie, triumph of the middle class, and I thought that this is sort of, you know, very nice background to what I'm going to say in how many minutes? Okay. Now, this is going to be a very convoluted and disorganized talk, much more disorganized than I usually give. So to guide you through it, I'm going to make three arguments, by and large. First of all, Eastern Europe is a perfect region for studying middle class, because it's a peripheral region of Europe. It's a very backward and underdeveloped region of Europe. And during the last 150 years, there were three dramatic modernization movements which were trying to, you know, bring Eastern Europe back to Europe, right? So mid-19th century, second half of 19th century is the first one, then after the First World War is the second one, and then, of course, communist reconstitution of Eastern Europe is the third effort, really, to sort of, you know, build economic powerhouse in this part of the region. So that's the first argument which I'm going to make. Now, the second argument, which is supposed to be one of those outrageous ones, is that the collapse of communist regimes is the successful middle class revolution. And I think that when you look at the dissolution of communist regimes from that perspective, many puzzles which we have with why this happened and why in that way and why different actors behave in the following way and other way, this explains the story in quite convincing way, and I will go briefly through it. But the third thing which I want to say, and this is the most outrageous thing I will try to say, is that this is the last middle class revolution. That only the peculiarity of the communist system allowed the middle class to be a successful revolutionary class. That post-modernity, I waited to use that, you know, as a political scientist, we're not allowed to use this concept. The conditions of post-modernity really make middle class or middle classes politically impotent, and I will explain this in a moment as well. So, briefly about the story of Eastern Europe, the defining predicament of Eastern Europe is backwardness and peripheral position in Eastern Europe. But at the same time, and this is the paradox of the region, is that the elites of the region had this incredible fondness for Western civilization and style of life and culture and everything, right? So, you know, on the one hand, you have those poor peasant societies. On the other hand, you have this cultivated elites where every child is forced to learn French and all the things which goes with it. Now, because of that backwardness, this part of the world has a very distorted class structure. When I say distorted, I mean by West European standards. So you have a very small working class, starting with the sort of second half of the 19th century. You have a very poor and huge peasant class. You have ethnically divided bourgeoisie, very weak one, with the Jewish, German, and Greek in some parts former Soviet bloc, so it's very weak and divided. And then you have this declining, decaying mobility, nobility and upper classes. And I think that distorted class structure creates the conditions for reverse modernization. And I think when I say reverse modernization, I mean that it starts from culture, goes to politics, and ends up in economics. Right, so this is not your traditional, British English model of economic development. Here are cultural elites building political system and creating capitalists in the end. And I think, you know, you have two efforts of this, and Ivan Seleny, of course, is the person who makes this argument in the most powerful and wonderful way, that you have those two moments where the cultural classes were trying to build capitalism without capitalists. So that was the predicament and that effort of reverse modernization. But it stopped in the mid of the 20th century because of the Second World War and collapse of those independent regimes in Central Europe. And of course, what follows is the destruction of that middle class, which emerged from the 19th century going through the first half of the 20th century. Now, the destruction in very physical fashion, right? So consecutive Nazi and Soviet occupation, with thousands of people being killed, sent to concentration camps, and executed and disappearing. So that's one part of the story. And then the proletarianization effort of the newly established communist regimes finished off that middle class. Now, there's wonderful data on this, for example, like data on Czech communists who demoted several hundred thousand people from positions of authority in civil service, industry, cultural institutions, people who had education and experience and so on, and promoted twice as many people to those positions who had no skills really to be in those positions, no education, no work experience and so on. So we have this incredible reworking of the system. Now, the destruction of the old system, right, removes the role of economic capital, first of all. Bourdieu had this line in one of the talks which he gave in Germany. This was the only moment when he said something about the communist regimes, that this is the strange set of countries where economic capital has no meaning. So that's true. So under the communist regimes, the economic capital had no much significance. But also what was destroyed was ranks and status hierarchies in those societies, right? So I think that this created opportunities for a lot of social mobility, right? So those peasants from the countryside and those poor workers and domestic workers suddenly were sort of moved into channels of mobility and started to be distributed in different places in those newly built civil societies. Now, this ended up in new socialist middle class, right? Gigantic, well-defined group, which was characterized by a couple of things. Low income differentials, the composition of the old status hierarchies, non-antagonistic relations to other classes. This was sort of more horizontal diversification, and homogenization of consumption and taste. This was very important. You know, this communist regime in a very sort of clever way convinced people that needs are equal and people should need equal things. So, you know, having a small Fiat car was this dream of everyone, starting with the university professor and ending up with a poor farmer. They all wanted exactly this same kind of car, right? And it was the story like this with almost everything. Of course, official East European sociologists were talking about the composition of the status hierarchy and formation of the new strata, non-antagonistic societies, and they were right in a sense that through education, mass education, indoctrination, state employment, and politically regulated mobility, the regime created a very powerful middle class. No one talked, of course, about inequalities, which were built into that system, very powerful. And Ivan Seleny, again, you know, Ivan is a great hero of mine, wrote about this in a very powerful way. There were power hierarchies, which were very important, and, of course, secret consumption. You know, there's this story about the stores with the yellow curtains. And everyone, you know, you say that in Poland, and everyone knows what it is. Stores with the yellow curtains were the stores for party officials and top party apparatchiks, where you could get the goods no one else could get, right? And the secret consumption of luxurious goods was sort of constant element of life in those countries. So here we have this new class. Now, in the mid of 50s, there is this big crisis, which somehow is the end of the forceful transformation of those new middle classes in Eastern Europe. So this Stalinization crisis, the big revolution in Hungary and crisis in all the other countries produce that very important moment in which the Communist Party realizes that they have to give concession to society. Right? This is something which sociologists sometimes call the new social contract. The party agrees, by and large, to accept the fact that the population, the middle class, have needs, ambitions, and expectations. And they make an effort to sort of respond to those ambitions and expectations for the promise that that class will never try to enter the politics, right? It's a little bit like China today. You know, we can get rich, get stuff, get out of politics, right? And we will help you to get the stuff as long as you get out of politics. This was the East European story in the 60s and in the 70s. It was called little stabilization in Poland. In Hungary, it was called goulash communism, right? So it had even those specific names. But the problem the Communist Party had was that they were not able to keep their part of the bargain. They couldn't really respond to the rising expectations of the middle class because very inefficient economic system. The moment they tried to bring something from the West, the things were even worse because those consumer goods from the West look so great. You know, they had these wonderful packages. The value of it was incredible, right? So things were even worse when you were trying to import some stuff to those countries. Now, so solidarity movement, that's the point I want to make, and this is the point about the revolution. The solidarity movement was the modern middle class revolution. Huge alliance which crossed all the class and social lines. Right? This was very unique events. And for that alliance, where that middle class became a real collective actor, what was needed was very peculiar identity construction. When you think about the discourse of solidarity movement, when you think about different elements put together, this completely unique political ideology, right? And of course, you know, this illustrates perfectly a very old idea, right, that the rising expectation, when they crash with reality and create the gap, then you get social mobilization. Right? So Davy's curve from 1962 in many ways explains what happened in Eastern Europe, and the main player in this game is, of course, the middle class. Now, how much time do I have? 10 minutes, okay. Now, if we rethink the collapse of communist system in Eastern Europe that way, then we can explain a number of puzzles which we have in the field. So one big complaint about East European revolution is, starting with Führer and some others, that this were revolutions without ideas. How come that such a huge revolution is without new ideas? Because it was middle-class revolution, and middle-class revolution is not a revolution with new revolutionary ideas. It's a very simple revolution. People want a normal thing that middle-class people want, right? Efficient services, good education, opportunity to travel, consumer goods, and so on. So why should one expect revolutionary ideas from the middle-class revolution? Now, the second, you know, big puzzle is why everyone believed so much about political participation. You know, this was like Chartist-like sort of, you know, mythology, that the moment we start participating in political system, everything is going to be resolved, right? Again, you know, this is the sort of petit bourgeois misguided thinking that political participation really will provide everything, right? Economic equality and huge consumption and everything, right? Right. So this is the second puzzle. Now, there was no class preferences in East European revolutions. You know, you have the workers who want privatization, right? You have the trade unions who want foreign corporation to take over the companies. You have people who want flat tax, poor people who want flat tax, right? And you can sort of multiply these examples, and someone says, what the hell is going on, really? Why those people whose class positions are so obvious want things which are completely contrary to those class positions? And again, the answer is that this was not thinking in class categories. This was thinking in this sort of broad middle class things, idioms where those things were not very important. Now, how should we think about different outcomes of revolution in Eastern Europe? Now, this is a very simple story. Today, there are four different sets of countries which emerge from the former communist system. So you have a bunch of countries which transformed economically in a very dramatic way, like China and Vietnam, for example, but did not have political revolution. And then you have a countries, the yellow line is East Central Europe. This is a successful transformation which resulted in the consolidated democratic systems. The Balkans are sort of moving in this direction because of the EU and some other factors. And this is the former Soviet Union without the Baltic republics. Which
what are the axes? I'm sorry.
Right. what happened to this? Now, this is Freedom House. This is Freedom. You know, these are years here, right? So this is time, and this is Freedom House. Very, very sort of imperfect index the Freedom House produces of the rights and liberties, right? So this is a measurement of the the quality of democracy by and large. 89. This is 1989-91, right? Sorry for that. Now we can think about this in the following way. Why do we have those two, right? And those two. And I think that the one way to think about this would be to say that there was something about middle class in these two places which was different than in those two places. And if I would say what was the different thing, probably the idea would be that the middle class was weaker because it was more service class for the state, right? So in China, for example, or in some former Soviet Union countries, the largest segment of the middle class was the service middle class, like in old Tsarist Empire, the service nobility, right? So you would less expect that service class to overthrow the regime and move transition in completely different direction. Another possibility is that the mobilization was done on ethnic lines. This is like alternative, right, to middle class liberal mobilization vis-a-vis ethnic mobilization. Ethnic mobilization could account for this. Okay. Now, but middle class is not gone in Eastern Europe after the transition. I just want to show you a couple of interesting things. Here is the extent of the initial recession in Eastern Europe, right? So you have 50%, 40% drops, not only in industrial production, but this is, I think, GDP per capita, but you have drops in industrial productions and other things. Now, you would expect that in the situation like this, people will stop shopping, right? This is what we have, right? This is our problem today. Recession, people stop shopping. This is a problem. Now, here is the real income in Poland, right? So, you have 25% drop of income in major groups. So you would, again, expect that with this drop of income, people will stop shopping. But no, middle class is very resilient. They want stuff. Right, so exactly, in the moment when you have that dramatic recession in the country and this dramatic drop of income, you have dramatic increase of the number of stuff people buy, right? So that's sort of the indication that the middle class that was the middle class revolution. You know, they overthrew the regime and started to buy the stuff, right? I'm saying outrageous things. Okay, one more thing. We know that status hierarchies are very important for the middle class. So this is 20 years into transition into capitalism, right? Where you have a lot of people who made a lot of money setting up enterprises, becoming members of the European Parliament with gigantic salaries and so on. You would imagine that after 20 years, the middle class would reconsider what kind of professions are good for children. No, but these are very powerful and long-standing things. So, the first, scholars. You know, with the salaries in Eastern Europe you have at the universities, this would be the last profession you would like to have for your children, right? But no, in rankings of social status, the scholars are at the very top. Then the nurses, the teachers, the dentists, the doctors, journalists. And then you start from the bottom, and these are the members of the parliament. And, right? These are politicians. No, these are